fascinating. Gadgets, gizmos, and gear-based technologies.
Welcome to FGGBT. Now, this is the show that takes your favorite fictional science and technology, and we make it a reality. We are the Brain Trust. I am the analytical mastermind, Daniel J. Glenn. With me, the physics phenom, Dr. Michael Denon.
Dan, great to be here. I always love when, you know, the fact that I'm a good dad and I'm willing to watch my daughters play video games comes in handy for things like this. You named a thing we were going to do. I'm like, oh, maybe I know it. Maybe I don't. Then I realized I do because I'm a good dad.
I love that you call it a thing we're going to do here. Hey, how you doing? An unknown thing. It's impossible to know, much like our enigmatic engineer, Ben Siebser. Ben, how are you doing up there on the Brain Station?
Dan, I've been hearing a lot of chatter these days about survival bunkers. And I just have to say, these folks have got it all wrong. Why would you want to be cooped up underground with no view when you can ride out the disaster in space on a beautiful survival station just like this one?
You know, you make a great point here, Ben, because we're going to talk about bunkers. We're going to talk about radiation, and that's in space as well, as we discuss Fallout, the series that is both a comic book, video game, television show, and just a really cool world here. And Denon, I know you mentioned you like being a good dad. This video game series is full of okay dads, some not so great dads. So you're hopefully going to be a shining example. But not only that, Denon, I thought you would like that because we're going to pair this with another episode that will be our equivalent of Jetsons and Flintstones 2.0. Because this world feels like the Jetsons if George Jetson had somehow caused a nuclear apocalypse somehow, you know, a couple years after he took over at Spacely Sprockets.
Well, you know, if anyone's going to cause a nuclear apocalypse by accident, it is going to be George Jetson. And yeah, it doesn't even have to be after he takes over. So I think, Dan, as always, the analytical mastermind has analyzed this accurately and precisely.
I mean, this is clearly just the next season of the Jetsons. No, they didn't have enough. The network didn't believe in them enough to let them take the dark turn.
Right. I mean, it's quite a pitch. It's quite a creative swerve, let's say, yeah. Right? Because Fallout, it takes place, you know, what's interesting is I thought the tagline was, you know, when the movie first came out, that it kind of took role-playing games out of the dungeon and into the post-apocalyptic future, right? So the games are all role-playing games that are set, you know, the dungeons are subways that are overrun with gigantic, you know, radiation-induced mutated monsters, and there's, you know, people who are left over from the Fallout who are scrounging for supplies. It's a dangerous world, you know, but it's really kind of an alternate history, right? Like it kind of Fallout follows our world storyline basically up until World War II and, you know, the atomic bombs where, you know, we become kind of fearful and it creates the Cold War and it really affects world politics. In this world, guys, they really double down on nuclear energy. And that kind of really influences the aesthetic and the world that will eventually become what Fallout becomes.
Yeah, and it's, you know, I'm glad you pointed out our Jetson episode, Dan, because it really goes to something we've talked a lot about on this podcast, and that branching point between when you get an energy revolution versus a digital revolution. And this is really about an energy revolution. And the interesting thing is it's a theme in some science fiction, but not as much as you would think, where you've managed to get small-scale nuclear power. And mm-hmm. I think that's really like the big piece here. It's not just going all in on nuclear power in terms of big plants, but it's going all in on miniaturizing nuclear power, which I think is the right. Cool piece.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And in way better ways than what we have now. You know, we have, you know, the Mars rover has a nuclear battery, but it's, you know, it's basically just a hot rock with a thermoelectric device on it. But right. It seems to me like the things in Fallout are way more advanced than this. You know, maybe even microfission or microfusion reactors, which are much more efficient.
Well, it seems to me because, you know, everything's nuclear, right? Everything, you know, whether it's your household appliances, you're able to have little robots as house cleaners. They use them, you know, robots as police. So they're able to kind of power all of these robotics and like that, but also your appliances. And it made me think of Back to the Future, as almost everything does, guys, let's be honest. But, you know, the DeLorean is powered by the flux capacitor, and you just stick a couple of plutonium rods. You know, as they joke, you know, maybe in the future, plutonium's available in every corner drugstore. Well, in this world, it kind of is, because I'm guessing that's what they're using to power it up, you know, is some sort of version of nuclear rods like you'd see in a mini power plant.
Well, Dan, I thought you were actually going somewhere else where when he comes
back. Where else
back
am I going to go? That's a
Well, no. Back to the future. With all of that, but the banana peels, like when he gets the Mr. Fusion.
Right? Yeah.
That's where I thought you were going, Dan. Not that we need plutonium rods. We just need a Mr. Fusion with banana peels to create our plutonium rods.
But it comes later. It comes later.
Yeah. But I think what's interesting about this. Right. And plutonium is the main thing we use in fission. So the cool thing is, if we can get microfusion, you don't even need plutonium anymore. We're really stretching things. But if you think about it, the handheld devices use a lot less energy. So you could use really small amounts and spread it around. You know, a big power plant is, you know, driving the energy for a city. Hence, it's a big power plant with big, you know, rods. Right. You know, your handheld, whatever it is, fission, fusion, thermonuclear, you know, battery, doesn't need to make as much energy. And that's, I think, what makes it the dream, Dan. That's how we want to get there.
I find it funny when you think about a handheld nuclear device as being, it's not exactly something I want to hold in my hand. And maybe that's just because that's the future I'm in, but maybe then it's a little better. But, you know, it's an interesting world because, you know, quickly things get out of control. And I'm just going to throw some dates because I think that they're interesting when it comes to a timeline. You know, in this world in 2077, there's a big war and it's a nuclear exchange. So it's between the U.S. in China, and lots of major metropolitan areas are hit with nuclear bombs. About, you know, 30 years later, 2102 is in the newest Fallout game, the MMO, is Reclamation Day, where people are starting to come out of the bunkers and are able to live. So this is 30 years after, right? Mm-hmm. But in Fallout 3, they talk about 2227 as being a time when people come out of the vaults, and at 2377, where everyone can completely take over the U.S. Now, these seem like conflicting dates where people are coming out of the vaults to reclaim the U.S. Now, radiation's going to be a problem here, guys. Fallout, half-lives, whether things can actually be livable, you know, we can use, as we talk, Chernobyl as kind of our template here, because that is a nuclear disaster on a much smaller scale than the entire U.S. But we got to tackle radiation here, guys, because radiation is both a cause for the gigantic mutated creatures that we see in these games, but also, you know, your water's irradiated. I always get this wrong, Ben. Help me out here.
Irradiated.
The third option that I didn't say. There's radiation everywhere. It's in our water. It's in the food. It's all over the place, and it damages your health bar, which means it would damage you. So, Denon, radiation here, it's a big problem causing multiple issues. Let's talk about it.
Well, first of all, it's really important, I think, for people to understand there's the different types of radiation and the different damage. The types are varied. Let's shelve that, come back to it, because that's important. And you've talked about, you know, water, background radiation, all of that. We want to get to that. But there's the damage it causes. It's basically two types of damage. There's what we might call burning, destruction, breaking down cell walls, the physical damage to you. And then there's the other thing you mentioned, you know, the giant mutated animals. There's genetic mutation damage that is the thing we think about standardly. I think people are most scared of mutations, Dan. I'm actually most scared of getting burned alive and physically damaged because, you know, if I mutate, you know, hey, maybe I just go on a rampage, but I'm still alive, right? If I burn to death, I burn to death. You know.
No, that is a problem. Well, I mean, radiation is responsible for superpowers, but also if you're worried about burning to death, you've never been attacked by a gigantic ant that has grown to this 50 feet because of radiation, which we all know is inevitable. Not only possible, but inevitable.
It is true. I've never been attacked by a giant ant, but as we know, I do enjoy playing with fire, so the risk of burning to death is very, you know, very front and center for me, Dan.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's important to realize that despite what the seeming very, you know, science fiction-y and out there, we have everyday experience with this because we all understand the difference between our microwave oven and UV radiation. These are two forms of radiation that do very different things. Microwaves in the microwave oven is that damage. It cooks things. You know, you take your burrito, whatever you want to eat, you stick it in your microwave, you know you're just going to heat it up. You're going to make it warm. You're not going to mutate your burrito into, you know, a burrito that attacks you.
Well, that's true. Well, Denon, in fairness, we do all of our genetic modification of food outside of the microwave before we put it's fully mutated before it goes in
Those are, Dan, the useful mutations to make it taste good, not the mutations to make it attack you. Right?
Agree to disagree, but continue, please.
Well, and the contrast is ultraviolet radiation, which we actually go to great lengths now to protect ourselves from because we know that can cause mutations that can lead to skin cancer and other things. So understanding the difference between, am I going to just be damaged, which in principle I can heal from, or am I going to be genetically mutated, which are much more permanent changes to your body. And what's interesting is the underlying physics is kind of cool because it comes down to the fact that 5 no longer equals 5 when you think about radiation, which I know is a strange math statement. Mm-hmm. But you can just imagine taking like 5 billiard balls that you're going to throw at a wall, right? Okay. You might dent the drywall, you might do some damage, but you're not going to bring down the studs because individually they don't have enough energy to cause stud damage, which in my analogy is genetic mutation. But now take 1 5-pound cannonball and shoot it at the wall, you're going to damage that stud because it's in the right sort of set of energy coherently together. So 5 individual 1-pound billiard balls does not equal 1 5-pound cannonball when it comes to radiation damage.
Right. And that also gets into how you protect yourself from this stuff. Lower energy radiation, you can stop with very thin shielding. So if you think about with the wall, if you put a heavy moving blanket on your wall, you're going to stop those billiard balls pretty much indefinitely. They'll just bounce off, not do any damage. But if you want to stop that cannonball, now you're talking about needing some armor plating or some other fancy stuff to protect your wall.
So the knights had it right. Full plate armor is really how we should walk around in Fallout, is what
you're
saying.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, make sure there aren't any gaps.
You know, Dan, if you want to be really careful, you just take a playbook out of the dentist's office, full lead armor.
Okay.
Is where you want to go. Because lead is, and just don't eat or drink it because you could get lead poisoning, but wearing it, very safe.
When you're in space, you know, when you build your bunker, you need to, if you want to have like a viewing area, you need to protect it with, you know, water's also great at absorbing the radiation. So if you look out of your viewing dome through a lot of water, that'll protect you from the radiation too.
So there's a lot of rules here, but we can by, is what you're saying. Don't drink your lead vest, and what you can drink, instead put over a dome so you can see out of it. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting. Yeah. It's an interesting world we live in. Well, that aside, you know, let's talk about these animals, because in the world of Fallout, there's really nothing normal left. You know, you've got rad scorpions, which are gigantic scorpions that can kill you, rad rats, rad stags, which are like deer with two heads, rad roaches, and some are even glowing. Like I mentioned the ants earlier, Den, and some are glowing from the radiation. Not only do you have to fight off these creatures, but you're required to eat them to survive. Now, I recommend if you're in the game, you're going to want to cook that meat before eating it. Eating it raw is even probably worse than eating it with all the radiation, but we're going to talk about that. This is very much like the 1950s science fiction movie, Denon. So let's talk about this. Let's talk about these creatures, and I'm really curious how you would, like, what's your favorite recipe using Rad Rat as your base?
Well, you know, for me, I'm not going to use Rad Rat as my base. I'm going to try and find some genetically mutated chocolate, Dan, okay. and make rad chocolate chip cookies.
Okay.
and that sentence actually sounds cool, right? Rad chocolate chip cookies, I think sure. you could enjoy.
Yeah.
I have a feeling that, a radiation-induced world would actually tend to be the one thing that turns me into a vegetarian.
That's a good call.
Yeah. Now, but one thing that I think is fascinating about this is you mentioned these different creatures, and we really have two types of mutations we see both in this world but in science fiction in general. You have the creature that is basically the same size but has things like two heads, extra claws, maybe a little extra plating, maybe they're super strong, whatever. And then you have things like, because insects are scary enough as they are, but then you make them big, Dan, and they're super scary, right?
Yeah.
So you have the size mutation. And I think it's interesting from a physics point of view because it's unlikely that the size mutation would survive and be real because we know all the physics of making things big and what goes wrong. There's a reason ants are small, right? Because of how they're structured. You would need a lot more mutations to make a big ant than just scaling the ant up. But you don't need a lot more mutations to get a two-headed stag. So I find that's one of the things I find interesting about this world.
Well, you can also, another thing to think about is insects used to be bigger when there was more oxygen on the planet. And in, say, a warmer world where maybe, some ice caps have been melted because of, nuclear holocaust or something like that. First you have the nuclear winter, but then, I don't know, somehow it melts all the ice caps somehow. But if you end up in that situation where there's more oxygen in the air again, like there was back in the, hundreds of millions of years ago when insects were bigger, well, now you have those big insects and they can survive again. In the normal world.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, whether it's the animals or, or the radiation itself, it's a part of daily life in Fallout, right? And I think that's what I think is interesting is just dealing with radiation and its effects is a part of your mourning process, right? In the game, there's chemicals that are used to, if you've got too much radiation, you've got Radaway that you can just kind of flush it out of your system. You've got Rad X, which is something you can take to prevent the uptake of radiation. Because the water, all the water you encounter has radiation in it, and you've got to work it out through various different technology. You can have some water that's boiled and it's drinkable, but you're still going to have radiation. There's other purified water. It's harder to deal with. It's all, and with the gigantic monsters, there's both energy and projectile weapons to deal with them. So there's, it's interesting how, my point is, in our world, we deal with radiation and we keep it at bay. We're trying to not encounter it at all. But what do you do in a world where it's just a part of living? I mean, do you just accept that your life expectancy is going to drop? Yeah, I think that's exactly what you do, kind of.
Well, and to some degree, those are real things, too. Part of the way the fallout damages you is you have these radioactive particles. Fallout is literally the dust, right? It's this radioactive dust that's all over the planet. And so if you breathe in that dust, you're breathing in particles that are emitting radiation all the time. And the way they can really damage you is if they're binding to into your bones, they're like, replacing the calcium, or they're just sticking into your organs in other ways. But if you have, you can take chemicals that will bind to those elements and at least allow you to flush them out without them getting stuck in your body.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think Ben, that's such a key point. So, Dan, we tend to be lazy. We use the word radiation both for the actual radiation and the source of the radiation, right?
Okay.
And when you're living in a sort of this type of world, what you're really worried about are the sources of the radiation, because it's exactly what Ben said. You don't want they're chemicals, they're materials. You don't want those materials in your body. And what's cool is you can make other stuff like the Rad-X and all of that that you take that is a better chemical bonder and flushes these things out. And so I really like that sort of basic physics piece of it, because when the particles are outside your body, that's the easiest radiation to take care of. You know, most of the time it's low energy stuff. You wear a little clothing, you put some protective gear on, and you're okay. It's the breathing or the eating or the drinking that's your real problem in this world. But again, chemical prep allows you to deal with a lot of that because you know exactly which chemicals are radioactive and which ones are not. So you can design chemistry to defend yourself against it.
Yeah, it makes sense. So, I mean, you just live with it. You just eat that blanco and cheese or whatever it's called in the game and you get the radiation and just take your rat away and deal with it. Flush it out is what you have to do.
It's sort of like the cholesterol pills I take now, Dan, right? Like cholesterol is a problem, but I've chosen to eat food that causes high cholesterol. So I take cholesterol pills.
And you flush it out. Yeah. I mean, that's... Hey, look, if you know what you're doing, chemistry is the wave of the future, you know. but it's, you know, I also think it's interesting because, like, if you look at Chernobyl, right, you obviously a gigantic nuclear disaster, unlivable for the next, you know, quarter and a half million years, right? It's going to be a while. But what's happening is a lot of the animals that are in that area are developing radiation resistance, you know. In a lot of ways, this is speeding up survival of the fittest. You know, I mean, you know, I'm sure you guys are both familiar with being in, you know, in early biology classes, microbiology classes, taking a petri dish. You know, we always went to the toilet seat and you rub it on the petri dish. You know, you incubate it overnight and you see what's there. Then the next day you do the same thing, but you put those little discs of antibiotics in there. And then you see the ring around that is clear of, you know, clear of those bacteria. But you'd always see one or two that were in that ring. And those are antibiotic resistant bacteria. Obviously running havoc here. But let's take that same analogy and apply it to radiation. As some of these animals are developing radiation resistance, they're the ones that are surviving. They're the ones that are thriving. As a matter of fact, I'm going to put up an article about worms, radiation resistant or immune worms that are growing there. And worms are what make the soil. That's the beginning of coming back from a disaster like this.
Yeah. And the worms are also the most exposed animals to the radiation because as the fallout dust of Chernobyl has settled, it's been covered up by, you know, new dirt and other things. And it's in those, that first couple inches of the ground. But that's where the worms live. So they have to be very resistant to the radiation, much more so than the animals that are running around on the surface where the particles are now trapped, for the most part, in the ground.
Yeah, no, and I love the fact that this shows... You know, the way evolution really works is select the things that are, you know, most fit to survive. And most mutations don't make you more fit to survive. They cause problems. But it is certainly true if you're in a radiation-induced environment, a mutation that makes you more resistant to radiation is clearly a survival of the fittest, as you said, Dan. And I think a natural thing in the future world is a lot of radiation-resistant creatures.
Though it's also interesting from an evolutionary perspective because being resistant to mutation also makes you less likely to mutate the beneficial to evolve into with new and better traits. So there's this very interesting trade-off between being able to correct errors in your DNA and allowing errors that may end up being beneficial down the line.
Well, see, this is where I think of it, Ben, as the first resistance you get is, as we talked about earlier, the resistance to the damage type of radiation.
Yes.
Right? Because that's really helpful. You don't want to burn. You don't want to get injured. You want to be able to survive that easily. The resistance to genetic mutation, you want to keep optimized at a rate of just enough to be useful, but not so much that you die.
Yeah.
I mean, but this is very true. As you mentioned, Denon, UV light is radiation, right? Skin cancer, you know, you can get skin cancer. So what do human beings do? Well, in places where you're exposed to a lot of sun, you develop melanin. You develop darker skin that absorbs, you know, humans have a way of figuring it out, you know. And that's light level radiation. That's not, you know, radiation like Chernobyl where it's life threatening. But, you know, again, as I mentioned, it's going to speed up that process. If you're born in that area and you're not radiation resistant, you're not going to survive very long. And those that do, you know, this process is sped up You know, so we're going to very quickly discover radiation-resistant humans. But, you know, I want to just quickly mention...
Oh, Dan, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
I just have to steal from you.
Okay.
You already went to your favorite, you know, Back to the Future. Uh-huh. Can I steal your second favorite, Life Finds a Way?
Sure. Yeah, it does, Dennis. It does. That, I think that's actually Ben's favorite.
Oh, is that actually Ben's favorite? Yeah. Okay. I know I'm stealing from someone. I just want to, you know, give full disclosure here that that was a theft, but it had to be said.
Yeah, I think if you quoted Big Lebowski, then you'd be hitting my second one. But
okay.
Yeah, Jurassic Park is all Ben. I think you wore out the tape, if I remember correctly, Ben. Yeah. Is that right? Yeah. I wore out 101 Dennis. Dalmatians, you wore out the tape for Jurassic Park.
Yeah. Well, I think I don't think, you know, that maybe that's a problem with my upbringing. I don't think I had it on tape, but I did have 101 Dalmatians like you did.
Yeah, I definitely wore out the tape on that. I had to, my mom had to buy two of them. And those are Disney's. Those went into the vault for a long time. Yeah. So I wonder if she bought two at the same time. Anyway, that's not important. What's important here is figuring out when can we get back out into the world so that we can watch 101 Dalmatians on a TV on the surface of the earth and not in a bunker. And when you look at Chernobyl, just really quickly, guys, I'm wondering, how long until it is habitable? You know, as I mentioned earlier, in the Fallout world, they're talking 30 years to 300 years before it's habitable. That feels like not enough time. I feel like the half-life on some of this stuff is tens of thousands, if not half a million years. But I don't know. Just quickly, what's the math here?
I think it goes, Dan, to what was the real nuclear power devices they made.
Okay. Right?
Because when I look at this world, what I think is interesting is the bombs create a certain amount of fallout. But if you notice, like, I mean, as tragic as the bombs we dropped in Japan were, those areas became habitable, ironically, faster than Chernobyl is sort of my sense, because of the way, you know, a nuclear bomb doesn't have a whole lot of radioactive material in it to begin with. Most of the radiation damage is in the actual explosion, not so much. I mean, there's damage in the fallout, but that's smaller and goes away quicker. Whereas a nuclear power plant has a lot of radioactive material that's not used up. It's fresh. It's there. And fission materials have very long half-lives in thousands, tens of thousands of years. But if they've gone to a real fusion economy and have managed to miniaturize fusion, most of the radioactive materials involved in fusion have much, much shorter half-lives. And if most of the radiation is just you had all of this nuclear devices and when the bomb hit, all of that stuff is now released, that stuff's actually going to go away faster. So I think a little bit, Dan, really does depend on what you said. Well, what is the material there? Because radioactive half-lives range from tens of years to tens of thousands of years. So you could be in any sort of situation.
Yeah, well, and you also have to think about it, because traditionally, nuclear bombs, they're trying to consume all the radioactive material they have in them to make the explosion as big as possible. And when you're doing that, you're breaking it down to short half-life or not even radioactive at all elements. So all you get is that big X-ray, gamma, whatever burst during the explosion, and there isn't actual, you know, radioactive particles left over, because if there were, you didn't get all the energy. But if you have, say, a dirty bomb or a misfired bomb, well, now that's going to spread that that stuff all over the landscape. And also, to Denon's point, you know, let's say if that nuke hits near a nuclear power plant and now that nuclear power plant blows up, it spreads all its fuel fallout everywhere. Or if you have those plutonium batteries in all your little helper robots and they get blown up, well, now you have little bits of plutonium everywhere because every house has a blown up helper robot.
Also known as a handheld thermonuclear device, I believe is what Dennis called it. And as I said, maybe don't hold it in your hand. But yes, but this is interesting because in some ways, this is the ultimate chain reaction, because every house has a nuclear device that is capable of causing a mini nuclear explosion that's not efficient. Is what you're saying, Ben, is the inefficiency there is what's causing all of the dangerous material to be sitting around forever.
Well, it's not just the inefficiency. It's that if you break open, if you blow up that nuclear battery, all of that stuff just gets spread out in the little area. And if you have them everywhere, you're going to get little fallout bursts from every house in the country.
And I think it's even worse, Dan, because...
Let's make it worse, Denon. Let's make it worse.
Well, yeah, every appliance has its own battery,
yeah,
right? So your house, I mean, it's kind of the ultimate in safety. I mean, think about it now, right? We're worried about our batteries. You're supposed to, like, avoid heavy metal poisoning by disposing of them, not in your garbage, but mm-hmm. somewhere else. Like, you don't want to, right? We worry about that heavy metal getting everywhere, right? In a world where everything's a nuclear battery, right? You're a little worried about that nuclear stuff getting everywhere. I mean, presumably in your devices, it's shielded. But what the nuclear bomb's going to do is break the shield. And you're basically,
exactly.
every house is a dirty bomb.
Yeah.
Of immense proportion. And that's the scary part.
Multiple dirty bombs.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. And that shows the hubris of the pre-war fallout universe. You know, that's why we have centralized nuclear power plants, because it's, you know, if you only have... you know, dozens of places where this material is, it's a lot easier to protect them than if you give every Joe Schmo, you know, half a dozen nuclear batteries.
Yeah, that is true. Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we've talked about the energy revolution versus the information revolution. And here there's clearly been an energy revolution, which has allowed for many different amazing things. One of the things that I thought is so interesting about the aesthetic of Fallout is that when you run around the world, you encounter computer systems. But the computer systems, despite being post-2077, I'm guessing, after the bombs went off, they're all like basically Apple IIe's. So they had almost zero information revolution, which I you know, Ben, is, you know, as someone who loves computers, that's a little strange that they're so far behind there.
Yeah, I mean... well, we see their technology seems to still mostly be tube-based, and they never really developed semiconductor digital circuits. Now, the likely reason, I guess, for this is because of this energy revolution, they never felt like they had a need to miniaturize for power reasons. Why you wouldn't want to miniaturize for, you know, size reasons? You know, iPhones are great. Pip-Boys are less capable and much bigger, I don't know. For whatever reason, the impetus to make the silicon semiconductors never came about, and they were stuck with tube technology, which is much bigger.
I think, Ben, there's a simpler explanation here.
Okay.
They drained all the scientists into the energy field. We know there's a conservation of number of scientists. And if they're all working on making handheld thermonuclear devices, who's around to make the mini computer?
That could be too, yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting, a couple of things here, because I've got another reason why they don't have semiconductors. But the first thing I want to say is what you're saying here, Ben, is that necessity is the mother of invention, right? Which is really...
oh, for sure.
How are we incentivized to do things? And in our world, we have limited energy resource. No matter what people want to tell you, our resources are limited, and we have to make them as efficient as possible. Well, there, if you've got an abundance of energy, you don't need to be efficient at all. Just make more energy. It's easier to do that and cheaper, probably. And the reason why they don't have chips, and Denon, I'm surprised you didn't say this as our resident ancient alien expert, but I don't know if Roswell happened. I mean, maybe if there wasn't a down alien craft, you know, maybe we don't have the microprocessors. So in this world, not only have they gone the atomic way, there's been no alien visitation prior to 1950.
Or perhaps with the unlimited energy, they were able to shoot the saucer down.
Right.
And it wasn't recoverable.
It's possible.
Yeah, they just blew it up.
It just evaporated. Energy weapons, as we see in this world, can turn anything into goo or dust, which is one of the fun things. But also, you know, this raises another interesting question I just want to touch on briefly is, you know, obviously, you know, despite what people may think, a lot of the wars we have fought in the past have been over oil. The ones we'll fight in the future will probably be over water. And the ones in this world are over uranium. So because they moved to that different resource and there's an abundant amount of energy, that doesn't stop us from still needing a resource and, you know, killing our fellow man to get it.
Well, you know, that's what I love about you, Dan, the sort of optimistic view you bring to things.
You did call me an optimist last episode, by the way, Dan. You're saying it sarcastically now, but you said it honestly before. You fluctuate.
Well, you know, There are moments where you know our true colors come through. What sure. can I say?
Sure. Yeah. That is my true color for sure. But it's interesting though, because there's always a resource that you need, guys. You know?
No, there is.
And it's interesting. Well, and speaking of resources, they're underground. And one of the other things that becomes a major resource and is also underground are the bunkers. You know, Vault-Tec in this world is this big corporation that is creating huge bunkers to basically put all of at least America, not necessarily humanity, but all of America underground in these numbered bunkers. I believe, Ben, it's 1,000 per bunker. Is that right?
That's what it says on the pamphlet, Dan.
Okay. So 1,000 people. This is interesting because we've talked about bunkers before. I find them really interesting. But an idea that a bunker would be built for generations of people underground and also have to be run so that people don't kill each other and there's some level of order in society. This, I think, is a whole different element that Fallout brings to the game that we haven't talked about in the past.
No, we haven't. And you know, there's a lot here, Dan. I think, well, one thing we've talked about a lot, actually, is the engineering of living either underground, underwater, in space, in these extreme conditions. And I think, you know, engineering it to be livable is not really my worry. And I do think underground is not that bad. We've talked about things. Radiation particles are an issue, but the reality is getting the air underground, filtering that or not filtering it, depending where you are, is okay. You sort of isolate yourself from the dust and the fallout. You've got natural radiation shielding. You can bring water in. There's a ton of water underground, right? I mean, we're using it up in California, but in general, there's a ton of water underground. So getting water, I'm not worried about. Food is an interesting issue because we've talked about this. Growing it is a challenge. I really think, though, the technology, the food, all that solvable. I think you put your finger on it when you mentioned the sociology of living underground. Like, what are the issues of living in confined spaces, living with set number of people? And so that's the part that interests me. And I do wonder, I'll just throw this out here for you all to think about and comment on. Like, this game was made without, I think, much VR provided underground. I mean, if you all have a, I'm not going to name the company, Vision Pro, because they haven't given us their money yet. you know, I was on my first flight the other day with somebody who had one on for the entire flight.
Whoa.
Like, does that make living underground better because now you don't feel like you're underground? I don't know. I mean, these are some of the interesting technology issues you can bring into the sociology.
Yeah. Well, with me, it would provide a lot of extra waste product from the constant vomiting to recycle.
God.
But
that's so pleasant, Ben. So pleasant.
But I think it's an interesting thing to think about because, you know, underground is, as you said, by far the easiest of the three we're talking about, right? Space, vacuum is hard. If you have a leak, you're basically screwed. Underwater, same thing. but we're really good at building things underground, right? We have very deep parking garages, very deep basements to buildings. We build missile silos and all sorts of other things underground. Mines. So creating these underground places is relatively simple. And so it is the perfect thing. And if you bring forward the energy revolution that does exist into mm-hmm. the bunkers, mm-hmm. well, you can easily, you know, have lights to grow your crops underground. You know, there's all these vertical farms nowadays, and one of their biggest problems is labor, but the second biggest is the energy they require. And you know, when the sun is free, why would you use lights? But if you don't have sun and you do have unlimited energy, mm-hmm. The light is essentially free, and you can create these farms and other things underground to feed your bunker.
The sun is free. That is a t-shirt if I've ever heard one. And speaking of t-shirts, Dan.
Oh yeah, Dan, you beat me to it. You know, we're in the apocalypse. And, you know, I'm surviving it. I can't see myself. There I am.
There you are.
Right. Happy. I am not in a bunker. That's why I'm smiling, because I am an outdoorsman at heart, you know. And I love the freedom of the world around me. Mm-hmm. And the sun is still free even after the apocalypse. So why not go out and enjoy it?
Yeah. Once the nuclear winter's gone, mm-hmm. you got plenty of sun. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, if you want to survive the apocalypse and not have to worry about Ian at all, become an android like my beautiful visage on this T-shirt. And then you don't have to worry about eating or anything. Androids are perfectly immune to the radiation, and you'll be just fine.
It's a perfect solution. And of course, if you know, we're underground, you're going to want people around that are very popular and nice to talk to. And so I have my very popular analytical mastermind T-shirt. You want to be the smart one running the vault instead of the person working in the nuclear part of the the bunker. I don't know. There's dangerous places down there. And of course, you can get all of this merch. fgbt.com/merch is the way to do that. But it's interesting because we talked about crazy computers before, and you know, accessing this might be difficult in the future with their Apple IIe's, but not in our modern society. So I think I think we've got a pretty good deal here. So I want to just touch on the sociology of an underground bunker here quickly, guys, because I think that is important. You know, when you think about it, once you're in the vault and a nuclear holocaust has happened on the surface, there's nowhere to go. You're stuck. You can't go outside. There's no escape. There's 1,000 people there. You hope you're in a group with the people you like, you know, with people you can get along with. But as we've learned in the history of tribalism in human history, when you get to groups that are, I think it's 120, splinters start to happen. Subgroups start to form. With 1,000, you're going to have many different subgroups, and keeping them all in order underground for multiple generations, you got to do some sociology and psychological tests beforehand to make sure that vault has the right personalities to get along, I think.
You know, I think there's some of that, Dan, and I think I was thinking about this because a lot of schools, like we experience high school, we experience college, if you go to college, are almost closed systems to themselves, right? They're not quite a vault underground. I think to some people, they can feel like it, right?
Yeah.
But often they're on the scale of that 1,000 or so people. Maybe it's just your class is 1,000. If it's a big school, it's more obviously, but they often are in that range. And many of them have a level of tribalism. I mean, we talk about the cool group and the geek group and the jock group and the drama group at high school and stuff. But they also have this shared identity of being their school. And what I've noticed is schools that have a really, really strong sort of identity, particularly if they have rival schools that they're worried about, do get along pretty well, even the subgroups break apart. And so I think part of the design is, I don't know, creating a competition, a rivalry between the different vaults. Like, I know that doesn't really come up, but I think that would be, like, that would be a cool way.
Can't go on the surface, Denon. I love the idea, no, but you can't go, I mean, unless no, you no, dig but like, tunnels to each other.
No, not direct physical competition, but okay. if there's cables and information exchange, right? So you mm-hmm. know, like, oh, we're doing, you know, maybe you have Wordle competitions, right? And we're winning the Wordle competition, and you share your Wordle puzzle every day with the other unit. I don't know, like,
yeah.
But if you could create that sense of identity, mm-hmm. humans, it's bad, but we really do well when we have an identity of ourselves as a group distinct from another group over there, right? And here, as you pointed out, Dan, these two groups now can't go to war because they're separated. Like, so you have this weird opportunity, I think, to maybe leverage what often turns out to be the problem for war at the scale of thousands to sort of a nonviolent competition by definition because you can't get near the other groups.
And they all do wear jumpsuits with their number on it. which is
right. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. You know, another thing. So let's take the violence out of it, guys. You said I'm an optimist. Let me jump into my little optimist jumpsuit. Okay.
Okay.
Vault DJG is what we're going to be in. Right. So if I think one of the other interesting things about being isolated in a group for so long, and we may be talking hundreds of years, you know, look at the United States. It was pretty homogenous at the beginning. Then people moved around, states started forming. And when you look at America now, every state kind of has their own identity. Some states have their own accent. One of the things that annoys me about watching television is when people have a Southern accent, there is no thought to how regions say things differently, right? There are multiple Southern accents, you know? And I think these are people who interact with other people across the country, and they're not really isolated. Some people don't leave their small town, but for the most part, we can move around and you can interact, right? Now, imagine you've got a state or a town that's underground. Language is going to change at an alarming rate. Accents are going to change. If anyone who's watched Swamp People, that's supposed to be English. You got to watch it with subtitles. You look at people in Scotland or some of the outskirts of England. That's English. I need subtitles. And I think that would accelerate to a point where you could have each vault with its own culture and its own language, right? And, you know, Latin existed across Europe, and now there's Romance languages, which are bad Latin, basically. So I see all kinds of interesting things happening in these vaults as they get isolated for hundreds of years.
Well, and it's also because they start from already selected groups, right? You're not, you know, the Vault 100 is only collecting people from its near area, right? Like, you know, you put a vault in every suburb, and so you have these already separated groups, which are now going to be completely isolated for 100, 150, 200 years.
Right.
And you're going to get crazy differences, right? You know, if you just think about, if you read like the English that was written 200 years ago around, you know, say revolutionary times, Civil War times, it's completely different than what we speak now. So think about what our English would sound like after 200 years in a vault.
No, it is very
true. I doubt we are getting it right, Ben.
Yeah.
I was just, it's funny. I just did a whole episode on Edgar Allan Poe, and I was reading a lot. And that's, you know, we're talking about the 1840s, 1850s, right? Mm-hmm. It's not that long ago. It's 120 years ago. But it's written in such a way that it's not how books are written. It's not how people speak. It's elevated language for sure. But even our modern elevated language is very different. And yeah, I just think it would get very interesting. There's this, there's this small town, and this is all going to sound like speculation and a complete anecdotal story here. But there's a town in like the mountains of Northern California where they've invented their own language. So you would say like, I want a horn of ale, and a horn means a glass, right? I wanted to interview them. I couldn't get up there and find anyone who was, you know, did this. But this is a small isolated town. So this happens here. So you can only imagine what language, I mean, just language itself, you know, as one part of the culture. But this is really interested me. And I don't think they really attack that much in this game as like they should, because I think even when people come out, you see differences, but they're people are pretty similar. I just think it would get weird, guys. I just think it would get weird, especially in the vaults where there's experiments going on.
Well, even without the experiments, Dan, I just realized you know you're going to get the Star Trek vault where they only speak Klingon after 100 years.
Right.
You're going to get you're going to get the Lord of the Rings vault where they only speak Elvish.
That's only nerd
and
stuff.
Then you're going to get the Dwarvish Lord of the Rings vault. You know, I mean, it just will. I mean, what I really want to do is join the Wookiee vault. I think will be fun, where you just sit around and scream at each other.
Just grunts. Look, that's the way we were made to be. You know, and speaking of grunts, another isolated culture are our prison systems, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I mean, the prison system, if you go in there, and I have, and again, speculation, I'm completely talking out of my butt here, but it's a very different culture, right? Like, there's different rules, there are different hierarchy, and it's pretty serious, right? But that's an isolated group, and this is the type of thing that can happen, you know, when maybe some of that culture is not compatible with other vaults. So this is, you know, we're going to talk about that in our next episode, which I'm very excited about. But before we finish this one, guys, we got to talk about our errors, additions, and omissions, things we wanted to talk about, but we didn't quite get to. Denon, is there anything about Fallout, your time in prison, or even even a Pip-Boy that you wanted to discuss?
Well, you know, I think for me, one of the things that was fascinating doing the research on this, because like I said, I was only aware of the one game my daughter played, is going back to that optimistic thing. Look, I'm an apocalypse denier. We all know that. And I think one of the cool things the Fallout did is in most of, I think in all of the games pretty much, the groups were all about trying to preserve humanity and culture. Now, they went about it different ways. Some were viewed as good. Some were viewed as bad. But I think that is the human impulse when there's a disaster this level, is to rebuild and redo. And I just go back to, I was in Lisbon. They had a major earthquake. And it was amazing how, like, I don't know, 1700s, people came together to rebuild the city. And I just think that's cool, like that human drive to rebuild. So that's my addition.
But what about you, Ben? Before we talk about humanity, anything you wanted to talk about that we didn't quite get to?
I think the thing I really like about the Fallout world is that it once again shows these preppers that you can't predict the currency that will be used in the apocalypse.
It's great,
you know,
yeah.
You're not using gold coins and silver coins because the hoarders screwed up the market or something probably. You know, you have a currency of the people, bottle caps.
Yep.
Because everyone has, you know, everyone started with a reasonable amount of them and it was fair. And that's what they use for currency. I think that's beautiful.
It is beautiful. It is interesting because you find bottle caps. And as you drink Nuka-Cola, which is the soft drink of the world, you get a new cap. So you get an extra buck. You're losing money by not drinking their soda, which is interesting. I had a couple of things I found interesting. You know, there's in Fallout 3, there's an entire city called Megaton and a group within that city that worships a gigantic undetonated bomb that has landed in the city. And it's interesting because people will always find religion and they will always find signs where they want to see them. And I will admit that an undetonated nuclear bomb is something, it's lucky is what I'm saying. It's probably divine intervention that might make me religious as well. But it's just kind of interesting. And the other thing, I think you guys will appreciate this, Fallout 2 is an older game, and I remember I started playing it, and it's very difficult. And when I started playing it, this is the early days of game books where you could find them online. And I remember I wanted to print out the game book so I could, when I got stuck, I could, you know, find it. It wasn't readily accessible. And I printed it out and I still have it. It's about a 300 page book.
Wow.
It's really big. And I printed it out. And I just remember it was like an hour waiting for that thing to print out. But it's got everything. So what I'm saying is, if you guys are looking to beat this game, I can help you out. That's one thing I can definitely do. But does anyone who has any thoughts on both helping me out with that game or any thoughts on the future of the apocalypse, how to prepare for it, you can tell us. Let us know about it. You can get in touch with the show on social media. We are on X, formerly Twitter, at FGGBTPod. We're on Facebook, at FGGBT. And our website is FGGBT.com. And of course, you can send us a question. Easy email, questions@fggbt.com. But you can get in touch with us individually. Denon, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me on, you know, X, Instagram. Just flip my name. It's at Denon Michael. You can find me on Facebook. You stick a prof in there, at Prof Denon Michael. You can find me also on Instagram at Physics of X. I've started making some Physics of X videos. You can find me on YouTube. I've been there long enough that it's just my name in the right order, at Michael Denon. And of course, I have a website because you need to have a website, and that's denonmichael.com.
I believe it's michaeldenon.com.
No, the website's denonmichael.com.
Is it Denon Michael?
YouTube,
is it?
That's Michael Denon. It's all very confusing. Oh,
so even I got confused, Denon. And I believe the Physics of X, that's everything. X is including everything of politics, right? It's all only politics show?
Everything except politics. It's not Twitter.
Okay, okay.
Yes.
Everything. Have I completely screwed this up?
No, no, Dan. It is crystal clear.
Well, listen, I will tell you one thing that is absolutely crystal clear is that Ben Siepser on all your major social media platforms. Do I have that right, Ben? How can people get in touch with you? Am I close?
Yep, I'm consistent. All the major social media networks at B. Siepser.
Well, how do you spell that for all of our listeners?
Spell that B-S-I-E-P-S-E-R.
And I can, you know, it would actually be fun, Denon, is if you told my social media and I did yours. Right. I think that would be really fun.
I don't know if I could remember all of yours.
Mine, it's tricky. You know, I'm not consistent. I am not D. Glenn on all my major social media platforms. What I am is on X, formerly Twitter. I am at Daniel J. Glenn. That one's pretty easy. Instagram at the Daniel J. Glenn. On Facebook at Analytical Mastermind. And my website is danieljglenn.com.
And you know what is super easy, Dan? It's super easy if you're listening on your favorite podcast platform to just rate, review, and subscribe. It's three things, easy peasy. Just do that and be done.
ABC 123, Dan.
Yep.
And if you're watching us on YouTube, it's also very easy to hit the like button, subscribe, and ring the bell so you never miss an episode. And also leave us a comment about how much Nuka-Cola would you drink in a day?
I think it's a lot. It's the Nuka-Cola looks delicious, and they've got several different flavors, Ben, no matter what you're into. But I do know that if you're into taking over the world, this information can be used for that exact purpose. So you got to watch out. You want to take what we say and only do good with it. Remember, when given the choice, always choose superhero, never be a supervillain. So until next time, thank you for listening.
Fascinating Gadgets, Gizmos, and Gear-Based Technologies is a Glencoe production and is produced by me, Daniel J. Glenn. The Fascinating Gadgets, Gizmos, and Gear-Based Technologies introduction was produced by Daniel J. Glenn and Paul Springers, with music and sound design written and performed by Paul Springers. Now, of course, if you're listening to this episode and you've gotten this far, you're going to want to subscribe. Well, how do you do that? We're on all the major podcasting platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. But if you're not already subscribed to those platforms, I made it easy for you. Go to our website, fgbt.com. You'll find links to those subscribe buttons and also links to our social media, both for the show and for our individual experts, the members of the Brain Trust. That's all right there. fgbt.com. And before you leave, don't forget to check out our other episodes. You can find the link at the top of the page for everything we've got, and you'll notice that we've got both a YouTube version and an audio-only version. Depending on what you like, we got it for you. And if you do like those videos, you can go ahead and subscribe to those as well. We're on youtube.com/DanielJGlenn. And once again, if you like this show, you're going to like everything that I do. Go to danieljglenn.com to find out more. Thank you for listening.